Okay, 2 Peter.
I think we just got through one verse last week.
Yeah, I think we did.
So, are we ready to talk about the flood and Sodom and Gomorrah?
Thought we had.
Nope.
Did you want to say something, Marcia, about it?
Pardon?
Did you want to say something about
I really want to hear other people's perspectives.
having trouble finding 2 Peter here in my Bible.
Is that one or two?
Two.
Chapter two?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, well, I couldn't
It
find it
would
in chapter
be
one.
God, it's the act of judgment of God. We actually did talk about Sodom and Gomorrah in terms of natural consequences. And that led to a really huge discussion. And I'm not here to try to convince anybody of my position on that, other than to give you the evidence that I've looked at and the reasoning that I've used. I'm not wanting to go through that again unless somebody needs me to.
Well, I think the language there, the key words that are contrasted in several verses is spare and preserve. That God didn't spare angels. He
Right.
didn't
Oh,
spare
that's
the ancient
interesting.
world, but he preserved Noah. And to me, that is either protection or withdrawing of protection. It's,
Yeah.
you can say or you can choose to believe that God was imposing these things, but it's just as easy to say if God withdrew protection, Satan could do all those things too. And so he didn't spare them, and the sparing would be protecting them,
Right.
which is what he did for Noah. He protected him.
My version has God condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to total destruction, reducing them to ashes as a warning to ungodly people. But how I think Sue's statement last week can be a way of a bridge to reach out to other people, and that is that we can ask the question, how did he reduce them? How did he,
Right.
just like we ask, how did he harden Pharaoh's heart?
Well, have you read any of the actual archaeological records on Sodom and Gomorrah?
I saw a video, I think on YouTube, on Sodom and Gomorrah. Oh, actually, it was on in a video that was in the library. They think they found what is called the House of the Carnal Tombs,
What?
and the rocks there are burnt. That whole area is burnt. And the
Well, I've
rocks,
read,
you can pick up the rocks and just pull them apart.
okay. I read an article years ago, and I think I downloaded it. And I don't know if it's still available on the web, but it was a very extensive article and with pictures, I think, even. And it was much, much more specific. They actually found ruins of the cities. They found walls. Some walls were still intact. They found skeletons, and they looked at the layering of the ash and the layers, and they said very clearly the fire came from above, not just burning buildings.
Right.
And the sequence and everything. And then they also said there was one place where it was very clearly there was an earthquake where in the middle of the city, you know how an earthquake shifts land. It was a 14-foot drop right in the middle of the city, just that much of an earthquake, which is a massive, massive earthquake. And then they also talked about the material that was out on the huge plain, which they would have all run out to, to escape the buildings.
Right.
But they said because of the what's underneath the ground was very soft, an earthquake would have caused the ground to just turn into like quicksand. Mm-hmm. And what they said, the evidence is that the bitumen and everything in the earthquake, it exploded up out of the ground. The sulfur and all that stuff literally blew up out of the ground, went way up in the sky, and rained back down in fire of burning sulfur. But it came from underneath, and the earthquake caused it to explode up into the sky, and then it rained back down, and the fire came literally from the sky. And all that was in the archaeological evidence that they found.
Wow.
And to me,
I've never seen that.
To me, that's like, okay, that gives the answer right there.
Do you have still have the link?
I will look for it.
See, there are statements by Ellen White where she says that Satan is, when God removes his protection, Satan is all too willing to come in and destroy.
Right.
So I think that question, how, is very important. Mm. The language is always going to be that God did it, mm-hmm, in some way. But I like your pointing out those words that aren't that way. And I find that true of the New Testament more than of the Old, that the language is clear.
Mm. What's interesting to me, though, is in God's or Jesus's conversation, not sure, with Abraham, you know, shall I show Abraham what I'm about to do? Though, you know, how do you, if that's what God is saying, how do you, that, to me, that's a little bit different than.
One principle I'll bring to this is that Ellen White, in the introduction to The Great Controversy, makes it very clear that only the Ten Commandments are verbally inspired. That means even where God says it, it's still human language. So they're describing what God said, but it's through their own language. So even what God says, I'm going to do, is human language. The other thing I would point out is that the word to do or make is, I'm not convinced that it's a causative word necessarily. It's going to be, this is what I'm going to have happen, or something like that, or have done. And again, we have to, with all the language, we have to ask, how does God do it?
Mm-hmm.
What is interesting, I did my study of the major and minor voices of God, God's preferred will, that in my own study of God's preferred will versus God's will adapted to the will of the people, this affects language as well. Because often the language is not the God's way of saying. In fact, most often it's not God's way of saying. It's his way adapted to the way of the people so that they can understand it and appreciate it and harmonize with it. So if you go to Genesis chapter 19, I'm sorry, chapter 18, what is God about to do? He's about to send some angels to Sodom. They're going to be attacked by a mob. They're going to have to smite the people with blindness. And they're still so intent on raping them that they weary themselves trying to find the door.
Hmm.
And finally they leave. So what God does is expose the truth about their inability to attack his angels. And he's about to do that. Then the angels take Lot out with his daughters, with his wife, and he takes them to a safe place.
Against their will.
Against their will, yeah. Because they weren't
willing. That's the closest he comes to forcing somebody's will, I think.
Yeah. Anyway, then what does he do? He lets go. He lets go of the forces that are building. Abraham approached and says, and God has not said he will sweep away the place. This is Moses. I mean, this is Abraham's language. Will you sweep away, really sweep away the innocent with the guilty? What if there are 50 people, innocent people in the city? Will you really sweep it away and not save the place for the sake of the 50 innocent people in it? It's not like you to do this, killing the innocent with the guilty as if there was no difference. It's not like you. Will the judge of all the earth not act justly? Lord said, if I find 50 innocent people in the city of Sodom, I will save it because of them. He does not use, I will not destroy them. He does not use the word destroy. Mm-hmm. Abraham responded, since I've already decided to speak with my Lord, even though I'm just soil and ash, what if there are 5 fewer innocent people than 50? Will you destroy the whole city over the 5? Abraham's still using this word destroy. Once again, the Lord says, if I find 45 there, I won't destroy it. He now uses Abraham's term. This is the major, this is a classic example of how the major and minor voices work in the text. Hmm. Once again, Abraham spoke, what if there are 40 there? The Lord said, for the sake of the 40, I will do nothing. He just stays away from that destroy word again. He said, don't be angry with me, my Lord, but let me speak. What if 30 are there? And the Lord said, I won't do it if I find 30 there. And I won't do it for the sake of 20. And what if there are 10? I will not destroy it. He's speaking Abraham's language. Mm-hmm. If God had explained this in his language, the people would not be able to understand it. Mm. Or relate to it. So there's that. Now I want to talk about something else, and this has to do with the flood as well as if there was an earthquake in conjunction with Sodom and Gomorrah.
And I posted the link.
Oh, did you? On the chat?
Yeah. You want to copy it before it's over or it'll be
Let me copy this.
But I went to the website. It's a archaeological site or whatever. And my link didn't work, but it got me to the site. And so then I did a search on the site. I just typed in Sodom, and it brought in a bunch of articles that they have. And so you can look. It's probably the same articles. It's just they changed the link since I bookmarked it.
Uh-huh.
So you can, there's quite a number. I don't know how many, but there was a number of articles that showed up from that site. And that's where I found all that stuff. I think you'll find it interesting. I did recognize the... you know, the page of the website. So it's, I know it's the same place.
Thank you. There's another thing I want to suggest. This comes out of an experience my mother had. Have I told this story before, Bill? An experience my mother had with violence?
Right now I don't recall.
Okay. Well, you're the only one that's probably heard it. If anybody has. My parents bought land up against the foothills of the Sierra Range in North Fork, California. The area was called Peckinpah Acres, and it was lovely land. The plot that they had a stream running through it on one side. Other than having lots of poison oak, it was just beautiful. So they hired a house built, and the person coming in to do the backhoe operations discovered that there was a granite underneath the soil. Mm. He had to go down layer after layer trying to get, he called it Half Dome because it was so bad. And he finally got down far enough and leveled it off where they could build their house. And then they had to bring in soil for the backyard. My mother was a gardener. She loved to garden. And she loved beauty.
So I remember this story.
Well, you listen to all my.
It's a good story.
So she brought in soil and she planted everything that deer. She asked the nursery manager, what do deer not eat? Because they were surrounded by deer and wildlife. And so she bought everything the deer wouldn't eat, and the deer ate it. And there became this hate affair between my mother and the deer. She would come take pots and pans and go out banging away with utensils, yelling and screaming at them to get out of there, get out of there. And they got to the place where they just look at her like, hmm? She got so angry and nothing would grow. Even the things that she did buy that the deer didn't eat, they wouldn't grow. And she kept being perplexed. Why isn't anything growing? I'm feeding them fertilizer. I'm watering them faithfully. They have enough sunlight. Why aren't they growing? And they just wouldn't. And one day she thought about it. She thought, you know, I have such a negative attitude towards those deer. And every time I go out and scream at them to get away, do you suppose I'm the reason things aren't growing? So she decided to plant more things that the deer would eat. So she planted things the deer would eat, and the deer ate happily. And by the end of the story, she was feeding them apple peels and had a big, big metal container out there that she filled with water so they had plenty to drink. And they would bang that thing whenever the water ran dry. She loved those deer, and everything flourished. It was a beautiful backyard. So here's what I want to suggest. Look at Genesis 4. I don't know that I like this version. Maybe I'll get my Hebrew Bible and look at Genesis 4. And I think it is 10, verse 10. And Yahweh said to Cain, "Where is your is Abel your brother?" And he said, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" And he said, "What have you done? The voice of the blood of your brother cries out to me from the ground. And now, cursed are you from the ground." Now, this can be an away from, but I also think it means the ground is cursing him. That this is a source of the curse. Because when you say you're from a place, you're saying that's your source in terms of where you're from. "Cursed are you from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand." And Cain said to Yahweh, "My sin," or you can say, "This is my punishment." Sin and punishment are the same word. In this case, "My sin is greater than I can bear," or "My punishment is greater than I can bear." And he goes on in that vein. Now, this story is here in part to prepare us for the flood. So then you come to chapter 6. There's three tellings of this story of why God sends the flood. Yahweh saw that humanity had become thoroughly evil in the earth, that every idea their minds thought of was always completely evil. The Lord regretted making human beings on the earth, and he was heartbroken. So verse 7, I'm going to the Hebrew Bible now. And Yahweh said, it is a word to wipe off the humans from the earth. "Off the land, the human race that I have created from the face of the land." And he would see, so he says, "I regret that I ever made them. But as for Noah, the Lord reproved him." Now I have to ask you, did God really regret making human beings? Is he so limited and lacking foresight that he doesn't know what would happen after sin? I just can't believe that God is that short-sighted. You know, sin has already entered the universe. And look what happens with Cain and then Lamech. And you know where it's going to end. Anybody that can be cause to effect can know what is going to happen. God is using human language here to express his sorrow. Or the writer is using human language to express God's sorrow. But it's human language. It's, even if God is using it, he's using human language. In God's sight, verse 11, the earth had become corrupt and was filled with violence. Now, if you take the Cain story and you multiply that by however many people are on planet Earth doing violence, the earth became filled with violence. What is the bloodshed on the land, the violence to the land is being multiplied more and more and more. And the consequences of that are the land is not only going to not produce, something terrible is going to happen. And I think that what we short-sighted human beings can't grasp is that our way of treating people and treating even the animal population has an effect, negative effect on the planet.
I agree.
And if that's the case, what about an earthquake? I was taught in physical geography that to cause the flood, all God needed to do was tilt the axis. Well, an earthquake can tilt the axis. If the earth axis is, I'm forgetting the actual facts, but if the axis is one way in degrees, we have what climate we have now. Uneven temperatures around the world. Uneven situations in tropical versus forest versus desert versus all the things that we have. If it's tilted another way, the temperatures and the life is completely the same around the world. Hawaii, around the world. If the axis would be tilted another way would be desert, practically around the world. The last major earthquake we had off the Pacific, in the Pacific, tilted the axis. And I said to myself, oh no, here comes a famine. Here comes a drought. We're going to have a drought. And sure enough, we did. And we still do. Violence, in my opinion, could cause the earth to become unstable and have earthquakes. And those earthquakes tilt the axis.
I believe there's a number of options that are very credible for the cause of the flood. And any of, and just like with Sodom and Gomorrah, if it was a volcanic activity, an earthquake activity, whatever, it's like God knows that these things could happen or are going to happen. But if people repent, he can interfere and block things from happening.
Right. He protects us.
If we don't repent, he's not allowed to protect, but he gets blamed for doing it.
Yes.
And I think the same thing applies to the flood. Personally, I think the best evidence for the cause of the flood is a comet. And I think, even based on what I read in Jude, that the comet being spinning out of control could have been the result of angels walking off the job in the rebellion in heaven and nobody taking their place. And so things are crashing into each other in space that may not have ever happened if the angels hadn't walked, gone on strike. And so God knows this comet's coming. He's pleading with the world, please repent, and I can do something about this. But they don't. And it would also fit that many times major events in history that God warns about correspond to signs in the sky. They, you know, I think even Ellen White mentions that before the fall of Jerusalem, there was a huge comet that was clearly seen by everyone, and the tail of the comet was pointing straight at Jerusalem. It was very ominous. And we don't think about that. Well, if there was a comet headed through our solar system, they may have seen it as a warning while Noah was preaching, and they just dismiss it. Mm-hmm. But if a comet hit, it does explain a whole lot of unexplainable things, like how did mammoths get frozen completely solid in literally seconds?
Mm.
On Earth, that kind of temperature, but temperatures can do that.
Mm-hmm. Whatever we pick, it seems to me that natural consequences or satanic forces or both,
yes,
are responsible, not God.
And again,
that statement she makes about the fall of Jerusalem and Great Controversy, page 35 and 36. I come back on that because that's where I changed my mind about this whole thing. And it makes so much sense, because if God is not the destroyer and Satan is, the clarity that brings is just fabulous.
The consistency it brings.
Exactly. And that was why I stopped writing my book. I could not finish it the way I was writing it. Still in my, as far as I know, it's still in my computer. I haven't touched it for many years. So can we move on from this, or is there something more we need to discuss about 2 Peter, that particular? You would think, as many times as I turn to 2 Peter, my Bible would be broken in enough to get there faster.
Question that I have from that then is, if violence, even violence against animals, has at least incremental impact on the environment, how would instituting a whole sacrificial system be helpful?
This is one I haven't worked out completely, but I'll give you as far as I've gone. Let me reiterate my way of reading the Bible to find the major and minor voices, because that I find is what is most helpful. I have worked out criteria for determining the major and the minor voices. Let me reiterate again, the major voice is God's will adapted to the will of the people, and the minor voice is his preferred will. And the minor voice comes usually at the beginning of a narrative sequence. It also comes usually in creation. Another one is where it is the same as the ancient Near East. It is the major voice, not the minor voice. And I think there's one other criteria, but I'm not remembering it. Anyway, I think we can run with this. You go to creation story, there is no bloodshed. In creation, everything is perfect. So if you go to where God clothes Adam and Eve with skin, it's hard to know what skin really is. The text does not clearly say that he sacrificed an animal. We read that into it. The interesting thing is, I did a study of Ellen White. When she does early writings, the story of redemption, spiritual gifts, all of which deal with her early great controversy visions that she had. She had more than one. When she deals with that, she does not mention God having Adam sacrifice an animal. She does not mention that at all. She does in Patriarchs and Prophets. And I find that interesting, because she did use sources. She did read what other people wrote about this. So I believe we have to realize the blood of Abel that the blood of Jesus is more. Okay, Bill has a question here. Is there a difference in killing animals and destruction that is angry and not angry? Well, there was an awful lot. I guess the problem for some of us, Bill, is that there was an awful lot of bloodshed from those animals.
Well, this, so I'm going back to the blood of Abel calling out, right? There's something where Cain had venom, anger. I mean, it was.
Oh, he was very angry, and he slaughtered his brother, I believe, as a human sacrifice. I believe that was the first human sacrifice.
And so there's
the language suggests it.
You know, the eating of animals after the flood isn't necessarily that same anger. I think of Native, I don't know if it's Native, but at least there's a movie where I remember this being in, and that was you thank the animal for giving its life for you in order for you to have nourishment. And that's not anger. In its
right.
So this is sort of where I'm coming from in the question, and the same would be in a sanctuary system. It's flowing with blood, but is it supposed to be removing the anger, removing
sin? No, it's not. But I'm going back to the where I think Marcia is coming from, because I've struggled with this myself. Why would God institute something so bloody that got so abused?
And then turn around and say, it was never my idea.
Yeah, and then turn around. I mean, you can find the prophets just railing against the sacrificial system, practically. And it's even in the Psalms. Sacrifice, I did not desire, but a body you have given me. Or do I drink the blood of bulls and goats? Things like that. There's nothing in Leviticus that says that God commanded them to sacrifice. It says when you offer an animal, this is how you're to do it. And this has not been given to Israel until after the golden calf. So we could assume maybe that they offered sacrifices with the golden calf, and God knows they're going to offer him sacrifices. Now, we do have Abraham offering a burnt offering, but we never have a command from God for him to do that.
And even Abel's offering.
Can I come back to Abraham for just a second? The idea of God calling Abraham. Okay, so what story are we talking about for Abraham's offering? And then the call of Abraham to go up and worship with his son.
Worship with his son as the human sacrifice, you mean?
Well, we certainly, it seems to be in the text that way. I don't have it right here in front of me. But it's always talked about as a test or something of Abraham.
You know, the rabbis, and I like their explanation, the rabbis said that, and Ellen White alludes to this, but she doesn't take it that far, that Satan stood up against Abraham in the court of the universe. And so this was sort of like Job. And God says, okay, we'll test him. So what is interesting is you have Elohim telling Abraham to take his son, and Yahweh, or the angel from Yahweh, of Yahweh, stopping him. So this Elohim, Ha, and it's Ha Elohim, the gods, literally, do this. And I see it as God, but it's in light of Satan's charges against Abraham.
And in Job's story, God says, you provoked me to do this to him. Yes. And yet it's very clear that Satan did it.
Satan did it himself. So I think comparing these two scriptures, we can say safely that God did not initiate that process of Abraham offering his son as a sacrifice.
Kind of like Peter too, when Jesus said, Satan has requested to sift you like wheat, Peter.
Yeah.
Do you have a sword?
Yeah. So And I think I have explained in this class because we've shifted around so much, I'm going to explain again. Abraham, the story is in two parts. In the first part, Abraham is the father of the son, of his beloved son. Those are really overtones for the Gospels. This is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased. Listen to him. Abraham and the son is Isaac. And they have the same three things they do in the second story or second part of the story. They have the fire. They have the knife. They have the mountain, same mountain. And they have the altar. But when they get to the top of the mountain, Abraham says, or binds Isaac, puts him on the altar, raises the knife, and a voice from heaven, from Yahweh's angel, or the angel of Yahweh, which could be simply Yahweh as the angel of Michael. It comes from heaven and says, stop. Do not lay your hand on this beloved son. Do not do anything to him. Those are the keynote lines of that story. And it shifts it to part two, where there's a ram that is the substitute. Substitutionary language is used. It's the substitute, but it's revelatory substitution. Why? Father, do not lay your hand on your son. Because in part two, Abraham is no longer the father.
He's not the father of a ram, that's for sure.
No. I asked this, I tell you a funny story. I had to teach someone else's class one time. And it was on this story. And I led them through part one of the story. And then I started leading them through part two. And I asked the rhetorical question. So is Abraham the father of the ram? And a young girl in the back row nodded her head up and down. I must confess, I had to smother my laugh.
So how did you handle it?
I pointed out that biologically that was impossible. Oh. I tried not to make her embarrassed. What you have here is a story about atonement, that the revelation about human sacrifice is that God hates it. He doesn't want it. Fathers, do not lay your hand on your son. Do not do anything to them. At the same time, it's at the cross. God the Father did not lay his hand on his son. He did not do anything to him. I had to have God show me that. God told me to read that story through and see if I could find it, and I couldn't find it. I was so steeped in how we read that story that I couldn't see it. And finally, he took me through it and showed me. And I was like, oh, and it was still like, really? It's so hard to change our minds. We're so steeped in something. So back to the sacrificial system. If God did have Adam offer a sacrifice, it was Adam who had to kill that offering. It was not God. Now, Ellen has a place where she says that God killed the lamb in the Garden of Eden. But she also says that Adam did. This is where human language plays enormous roles. Mm-hmm. And we either have to pick between. So I take the middle of the road, and I say, well, God helped Adam do it because he was trembling so bad he couldn't hold the knife. Even if that's the way we read the story, God never intended this plethora, this multitude of sacrifices. Never intended that. And I really think that's why in Leviticus it simply says, when this is how you do it. I think he must have abhorred the mount of sacrifices that David made when he took the ark back into Jerusalem.
Well, that was awful.
Every so many steps, another sacrifice.
Like thousands of them.
Yeah. So
is there a, is it when we, this I think goes back to our pre-program discussion, when there is a exchanging of the truth for the lie. With that exchange, with that surrender of the truth and choosing the lie, we no longer have the ability to value, as we should, creation.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And so it becomes cheap to kill. I mean, maybe it's not easy. Maybe it's foreign, and I'm appreciative of that for most people. but the idea that, you know, I eat meat, okay? I don't have to kill it. I buy it at the store. So, you know, ooh. But it becomes a commodity rather than a value of life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it seems then that is what leads it to be so very natural, or at least within our human psyche, now it seems very natural that life is cheap, and that the sacrificial system, I appreciate that God just seems to acknowledge the fact that we're going to do this, the golden calf. What's the first thing? Moses is taking too long, and they freak out or something, and so they have this calf. I still struggle with and I know this goes beyond what Second Peter, but it still has the language of this. God kills 185,000 Assyrians as they're coming around Babylon, right? Or something like that. This is how I remember it. So, I mean, there's a lot of texts where God is accepting the proactive agent language.
Mm-hmm.
Is this?
Well, even Jesus uses that language.
And is it just so much that the paradigm is so well established?
But how does he do it? That's the question I think we have to ask when we get stuck on that language. Is how does that, what does that language mean? I mean, in Jude, we're going to come to forever and ever. And in Revelation, even more, the smoke of their torment ascends to heaven forever and ever. How have Adventists interpreted forever and ever?
Ceasing of existence.
Until it's gone.
We have interpreted it differently than it reads.
Yeah.
Although I have to say, in the Greek, it means age to ages to ages. So it can allow for as long as it lasts. And let me explain something about how this was used in the ancient Near East. The language that we are static in our thinking, and that's Greek. Semitic peoples are dynamic in their thinking, and thus everything's fluid and everything isn't set in cement like we set it in cement. The word forever is used in an elephantine document. It's a contract between a man and a slave owner. The man wants to marry his slave. And so the contract reads something like this. It's in Aramaic. I read it for Aramaic class. And I'll never forget my amazement when I found out this word forever was used. So he says to the slave owner, I take your slave, so-and-so, to be my wife. And I take her forever and ever. And several lines down. Now, if she does not please me and I divorce her tomorrow or the next day. And that please me is always sexual. So the first night, she doesn't please him.
Short forever.
Ever.
Short is forever. So the ancient peoples did not read their language necessarily the same way we do. And that maybe should free us up for doing the same.
But now, I mean, it just, I can hear, you know, some of the people, I don't know, isn't it in Peter? I've left it. I'm in Genesis now, but there's something in Second Peter, I think, talking about, you know, don't follow these people who go off on their own tangents with, you know, and I just hear it with the freedom to interpret the way they jolly well please.
what if it's already been done? For thousands of years is tradition has been interpreted the way that it fits our
assumption, our
appeasement mentality.
Yeah.
I don't disagree. I'm just letting you know I hear.
Oh, yeah. Which means the majority doesn't always right, right?
That's right. In fact, that's rarely true that the majority is right. Truth is always a minority.
Can we put that in the sciences as well? I'm just saying.
It might be uncomfortably true.
I would say consensus is not necessarily absolutely true. And consensus can be a majority excuse for tyranny. And minority is not being guaranteed of having the truth. But I would say God's truth on earth does seem to generally be in the minority.
Because we have a built-in bias for error. The selfishness.
Well, selfishness.
I think the reason that that sacrificial system was so prolific is because all the surrounding nations did sacrifices. And the reason they did sacrifices, just a lot worse than the Israelites did, was because the pervasive view of the gods is the reward punishment system, and you have to bribe them to take care of you, bribe them to protect you, bribe them to give you what you want, all the above. And so they're trying to figure out how much is it going to cost us. And so Micah 6:6-7 is the contrast. And Micah says, so how do I come and bow before you? And then he begins listing exponentially increasingly expensive sacrifices all the way up to child sacrifice. And he's, and in essence, this is summarizing how humanity has viewed God. What is it going to take for me to bribe you so that you'll leave us alone or you'll bless us or whatever it is we need from the gods? And then God's answer is, I've already shown you what I want. And it has nothing to do with sacrifice. I want a relationship.
So why didn't the sacrificial system end before? I mean, even with as clear as Micah is speaking, why didn't it just end?
Why hasn't it ended yet? We just got a different version of sacrifices.
Well, we still hang on to it like it was just the most important thing.
Yeah.
Jesus is our human sacrifice.
Yeah, we, you know, it wasn't enough for a human child sacrifice. We had to get a divine child sacrifice because it was more expensive. And surely that would bribe God. That would pay him up. I mean, it's the most expensive thing we could find in the universe. It's like, wait a minute, God said he wasn't interested in that. And yet we're teaching it as theology. Mm-hmm. That's the ultimate child sacrifice.
And then we have taken that and said, with the evidence we've had today, even God hasn't offered his son. I mean, that was the illustration within the Abrahamic story with Isaac and some of the others we've talked about. And perhaps a right understanding of the way God said, when you are going to do this, keep in mind it's different than what the nations around you think.
I think the Abraham-Isaac story does parallel the cross in this way. God did not send his son to be a sacrifice to change God's mind.
Mm-hmm.
God, with his son, made himself vulnerable and handed him over, per didymi, in Romans, handed him over to let us do whatever we wanted to do. And because we have the appeasement mentality, we sacrificed his son to satisfy our demands for justice, not God's. And God was willing to make himself so vulnerable that we would do anything to try to get God to react, to vindicate our desires for revenge. And we couldn't get God to do it. All he would do is forgive. All he would do is love, which then we lost all of our support for everything we do. Because if we're reflectors of God, which is what it means to be human, Genesis 1, then if we're malfunctioning, we have to claim that God malfunctions in the same way to justify our malfunction. Except we couldn't get him to do it. All you would do is forgive. So the sacrifice was offered to us, not to God.
So in the parable of the prodigal son, which is my go-to place,
there's no sacrifice.
There's no sacrifice. But there's a parallel to what you just said, Boyd. Jesus goes out to intercede with the older brother.
Mm-hmm. Yes. To change his mind about his identity and his brother's identity. Because that whole party was purely to convince everybody of their true identity.
You know, I see the older brother as being guilty of the younger brother's decision to run away from home.
Yeah.
He taught him all the lies about his father that he had. It's evident. And when the older brother says, look, I've slaved for you all these years and you never gave me so much as a kid to sacrifice for my friends. He had a slave mentality. Mm-hmm. And the father counters with, son, you've been with me all these years. And I thought what we could have is a wonderful relationship. All that I have is yours. Because at the beginning of the story, he divides to them both his living. Mm-hmm. And the older son got 2/3 and the younger son got 1/3. And so the father had nothing left except the clothes on that he had and except access to this golden, to this calf that they used for the banquet. It's a powerful story of God revealing how he saves us.
And Ian Hartley commented recently on that story, something I thought was profound, that after the story, you know, the worst thing, the worst threat to the younger son was the possibly inevitable comment that the older son might drop is, oh, so you're thinking about running away from home again, are you? Like the insult. Like, oh, so you still haven't got yourself straightened out. You thinking about running away again? How often do we do that in church?
Oh, the older brother syndrome is alive and well, unfortunately.
Yeah.
You know what? We're past time. Let's decide where we're going to pick up next time. Second Peter.
Did we talk about Balaam?
No.
Oh, that's a good one.
Balaam?
Well, so mindless beasts.
Which verse is that?
Well, I see 9. Lord is able to rescue from their troubles those who respect him. Did we get to that? Or did we just sort of talk about Sodom and Gomorrah?
We only talked about Sodom and Gomorrah. So shall we start?
I guess I have. I've always wrestled with Lot being a righteous man, tormented in his righteous soul.
Why don't
what?
Yeah, why don't we start with verse 7?
Okay.
Because we haven't gone over verse 7.
Yeah, that's always puzzled me.
So let me.
God has to drag them out of Sodom, and yet he's so righteous that it torments him. It's like, it seems like an oxymoron.
Well, I would offer this explanation for what it's worth. And we can pick it up next week again. If you are more righteous than the people in Sodom who were wanting to rape angels, you would be vexed.
By comparison, yeah, okay.
By comparison. But it doesn't make him truly a righteous man. What is righteousness in God's eyes is always conditioned on where you are.
Okay. So that is definitely variable.
I think so.
Yeah.
God knows that this person was born there.
Yeah.
That's in the Psalms. And I see that as, I have to apply that to people that I know, or I get worried about their salvation.
Well, I agree. The other part that comes to my mind is genuine righteousness, whatever it is trusting God. The product of our behavior is relative to our lives and our environment.
That's
righteous in his day.
That's true, but Lot kind of falls flat on his face with that one because he has to be forced to leave the city.
Yeah, I know. But there's still a level with which he trusted because he still went. The wife turned around and didn't. You know, I mean, there's a level with which you do place trust, which is why there's not a bar or measurement to me. But so I see two parts of righteousness. One is the Salvinic righteousness. The other is our behavior to our fellow man righteousness. And I see that second one being relative to those around us and what we know or what we are able to do. I don't know if that makes sense.
Our righteousness is directly linked to what we imagine God is like, because we're going to reflect whatever we think God is like.
Mm-hmm. And our own is still filthy rags regardless.
Yeah.
So I put in the notes next week, 2 Peter 2:7 and onward. In case we need to remember the notes, you can save them. And I have.
Okay. I've underlined verse 7, so I know where to find it. Marcia, would you be willing to have closing prayer, please?
Sure. Father in heaven, we are so thankful that we can come together and talk about you, learn about you from other people's experiences with you, both in the Bible and in our group. And we thank you for that. Be with us all through this coming week, that we can join together again next week and continue our conversation and give us the love and grace this week to be like you. Mm. Amen.
Amen.